Good morning. Containment, mitigation, complacency, and of course, panic. A week is a long time in coronavirus land, and what a week it's been. It was going relatively okay, and I do mean relatively, until Thursday evening.
The Department of Health has confirmed 7 new cases of COVID-19 coronavirus, bringing to 13 the total number diagnosed in the Republic of Ireland to date. At a briefing tonight, the department's chief medical officer, Dr. Tony Houlihan, confirmed that one of the cases is a community transmission, the first such transmission in the country.
The 10 o'clock news, and on Late Debate, Katie Hannan got the reaction of Kingston Mills, Professor of Experimental Immunology at Trinity College. And such is the pace of this news that he took the call in a moving taxi.
We're just kind of grappling with this because obviously we've only had this news broken to us in the last just over an hour ago. How concerned should we be about, particularly about this community acquired case?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's changed the situation completely in that up until now we only had what we called import cases. All the cases we had were people who had come from Northern Italy. This recent case seems to have from what we call local transmission. So he acquired the infection from somebody locally in Ireland and they don't know at this stage who that is. That's another worrying aspect because clearly there's somebody else out there that's infected that they haven't identified yet.
So, crucially, one case of community transmission and in Cork University Hospital to boot. Well, yesterday, Sean O'Rourke spoke to Fergal Hickey, consultant in emergency medicine in Sligo, and he didn't sugarcoat it.
Now, we were saying at the outset, 60 staff have been asked to self-isolate, but presumably there's still a tracing and a fairly urgent one procedure going on with all the people who would have been in there as patients over the day at the relevant time.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't have the exact details because, as you'll appreciate, these things are not released into the public domain or even within my domain. But I am well aware that there is a contact tracing exercise going on. We've talked about staff, but there's also the patients involved. And of course, the reality is that the type of patient that is in an emergency department, and particularly the type of patient that's in an emergency department that is waiting for a hospital bed, they were a particularly sick group of patients, so they're typically elderly and they've typically got underlying medical conditions. So these are the high-risk group of patients. And in many ways, this is analogous to, you know, bringing a drum of petrol into a house fire from an emergency department perspective.
Quite an image that you outlined there, Dr. Hickey.
So, but I would say, Sean, that is a significant image, yes, but we need to not forget that we need to continue to do the things that people have been advised to do. So it's really important that patients who have been in any of the risk areas self-isolate themselves, and if they become symptomatic, to do what has been advised by the HSE. The advice is unchanged. It's just, unfortunately, we now have a group of patients who are outside that demographic.
And on yesterday's News at One, Anya Lawler spoke to Dr. Colm Henry, the Chief Clinical Officer with the HSE, and she asked him about the capacity of our health service to manage this crisis.
Because this is going to be the critical thing. And again, to repeat, we know that 80% of people will be, you know, they'll have an illness, but they'll be basically grand. It's the people who are vulnerable, it's the people who become critically ill, and then it's down to the 5% who will need a lot of medical assistance. And for that, you need intensive care beds, you need ventilation, you need oxygen. Do you have enough of those to meet what you predict will be your peak demand?
Well, clearly our intensive care capacity was already stretched, and there's no hiding that, and we wouldn't want to. We want more intensive care beds. But in the past few days, we've gained approval for an additional 22 ITU beds, which is a significant jump.
It doesn't sound like a lot. So explain why that's so significant, because a lot of people might think, do they not need more than that?
The clue is in the title. Intensive care beds is intensive care. It requires, it's not just the equipment, it's not just the bed, it's the personnel and the funding to go around that. And they're very expensive. It's a very expensive form of healthcare. But just to switch that argument a little, it's not just about intensive care. It's not just about hospital capacity. It's not just about hospitals. You mentioned vulnerable groups in your question, and that's exactly it. We have to focus in our planning on vulnerable groups who might not have the capacity to self-isolate, and that includes homelessness, prison population, nursing home population, immunocompromised. And that's part of our planning, which is actively undergoing now and which we're working with the Department of Health and indeed mm-hmm. with other departments and agencies in bringing to completion.
Dr. Colm Henry of the HSE, but all week long there were rumblings about large events, parades, for example, and what exactly we should do. And on Tuesday, Seán O'Rourke spoke to virologist Professor John Oxford, a man who was not mincing his words when it came to cancelling large events.
Yeah, I know what politicians are like. They don't want to do anything, basically, to upset the apple cart. But with infection, You can't just sit around and think, keep your fingers crossed and hope that everything's going to be all right. You just can't do it. And if you do, I know they'll try and wriggle out of the consequences and with all their excuses and all that. But from a public health point of view, which after all, this is protecting the whole community and everything, you cannot take chances. And I know St. Patrick's Day is important, but it's not more important than having quite a lot of elderly people dying, and it's not more important than getting every hospital in Ireland, the intensive care unit, blocked up, which more or less brings the hospital to a halt. And that's what.
But where do you draw the line, John? Because we've had, as we say, only one confirmed case so far. Now I take the point you're making. In Italy, 2 weeks ago, they didn't have any, and then all of a sudden it mushroomed in a very short space of time of maybe 10 days or so. I mean, are you? What would you say to the suggestion that maybe there has to be some limit to the steps you take?
Well, I think you should do what you can do. Italy is a terrible example, I think, actually. Everyone was skiing and having a jolly good time, and this virus is creeping around silently. It can creep because a lot of people can get it without showing any symptoms. It can move from person to person, not showing any symptoms. They were all having a good time with the skiing, having a wonderful time, but this virus is creeping around, and suddenly they had half a dozen people die. And then they thought, well, hang on a minute. What's this? Why have they died? And then they did a bit of investigation. They've died of COVID-19, the corona. Well, my goodness me, there must be 5,000 people in the community with it. Then they began to look and they found there were. So they were complacent, actually. I don't like to say that, but they were. And suddenly they're now the biggest outbreak in the world, almost.
Virologist John Oxford on Tuesday. The government, though, are taking a different tack. They spoke yesterday around about 4:30. Here's Barry Lenehan on Drive Time.
Now, speaking in the last few seconds in relation to what we are considering on large gatherings, Taoiseach Leo Varadkar has said the government is not recommending that at this stage any planned large gatherings are cancelled. He's also appealed for people not to take unilateral action when it comes to closing schools or cancelling events.
Which means the St. Patrick's Day parade is going to go ahead well. What was the mood of people on the airwaves during the week? Certainly at the start of the week, people were beginning to get quite worried, not least about the lack of information regarding exact locations of where the virus had been diagnosed. On Wednesday's News at One, Minister for Health Simon Harris spoke to Claire Byrne and explained their rationale thus.
What we're trying to do here is protect patient confidentiality, encourage people to come forward with their symptoms, because that's so important if we're to contain this virus. But at the same time, anybody who needs to be contacted, who has been in close contact, will always receive contact from the health service.
Will that strategy change if and when more cases arrive on our shores? I mean, will it be possible to not give out that information in the way that that it's being done now? Will you have to be more open with information as this thing progresses?
So if we were to, we have nothing to hide here, but we have something to protect, as the Chief Medical Officer says. If we were to start providing extra information, all you're actually doing is making people less likely to come forward with symptoms. So we have a duty of care to patients, to citizens, to protect their confidentiality. And that has to be our overriding concern. We have to balance that, though, with obviously public health and the protection of the public. If you got to a situation, and I should point out we're far away from this now, if you got to a situation where there were many, many, many cases in Ireland, you would move to what they call mitigation, where you would actually decide that there's so much of this virus prevalent in Ireland that it's no longer necessary to contact trace. It's actually about trying to treat the virus and trying to look after those particularly vulnerable people who may need access to healthcare. Anybody who tells you with great certainty that they know where this virus will be or how this virus will have evolved in a week's time is not telling the truth. This is a fast evolving dynamic situation, and it's a new virus that quite frankly the world didn't know about 12 weeks ago.
Minister Simon Harris on Wednesday, and on that same day, Damien O'Reilly spoke to Teresa. Her child was in a secondary school where a fellow pupil had been to Northern Italy and had gone straight back into school on the advice of the HSC. This, she felt, was putting children at risk.
I think that it would be better that if this child were to have been left, go through that 14 days, first of all, at home to see if by any chance he shows any of the symptoms. If he now shows them while he's in school, it's putting a huge amount of children, the teachers, their families, at risk. And why take the chance for one child in an entire school if there's even a slight question mark over it? Why take a chance on it?
And while Teresa was clearly worried, she was also concerned about how teenagers were feeling about all of this.
It must be absolutely horrendous now to be a teenager with having this to emotionally deal with it. And the fear, they're all watching television, they're exposed to everything. They've seen it all. They've seen the programmes coming in from China on the news and body bag zips being pulled up, people completely covered from head to toe wearing protective. It looks so frightening and so daunting.
Yeah.
And the children confronted one of the teachers and told one of the teachers in school that they were really frightened about this virus. And they know about a child coming back and that he has been in Northern Italy where they can see it on the news, that this is, this
well,
is an area
we know,
where it's
hit. We know, Teresa, as well, unfortunately, the way an awful lot of teenagers nowadays consume their news, and it's not necessarily from very reputable sources, as we do know.
It's on the RTE. The RTE news. How can you say that's not a reputable source?
Of course it's reputable, but there are a lot
it's
of... It's
not just the media.
But body bags and all of that, I think, is a little... You know, we do know...
BBC, RTE. Okay. Yes, it is.
But I'm saying a lot
every
of...
Every time the news flashes on, you
yeah,
can see
but that's,
them.
That's you, that, yeah, but you're talking about teenagers. They're being scared from what they're seeing coming from China. I'm saying an awful lot of teenagers, they
it's
consume their news in a different way.
Our teenagers in this country are highly educated.
I know. Will you stop picking up on every little thing like that, Teresa? I know that. And again, and do you know what I detect in your voice as well is of a caring, worried mother, like so many parents all over the country.
Ooh, a little bit of backpedalling from Damien there, but certainly an indication that in this particular conversation, the stakes are high. But then David rang in and he thought everyone was getting way too head up about it all, not least RTE.
I'm talking about the level of hysteria. It's just there's no balance in these sorts of discussions, I don't think. And I do blame the media to a large extent for the hysteria that's been that's sort of surrounding the whole thing. Top of the news every evening. As Teresa said, people in these jumpsuits and masks and all the rest of it.
Well, that's your opinion. It's
panic,
a very it's
panic buying. And I think that
no, but you see, blaming the media. The media will give you the facts, and we'll air the comments of the minister. We'll air the comments of the experts. We'll bring them on programmes, ask them the questions that we think everybody else. Now it's up to you to decide whether they're
Ireland. It's top of the news on RTE every evening. I think that that's a little bit OTT and it's stirring up the hysteria.
David on Liveline, and do bear in mind that that was Wednesday. It's been a very fast week. But in any event, I suspect David might not have approved of Sean O'Rourke's guest. Her name was Ida Millen.
I hesitate to use the name of your book, Ida, but it is called Stacking the Coffins: Influenza, War and Revolution in Ireland, 1918 to 1919. You're a historian of disease in Carlow College. Is there any remote connection between what we're going through now and the subject of your book?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, for a start, they're both part of the coronavirus family.
Golly. Well, here she spoke about the nature of pandemics and the difficulty of predicting their outcome.
We won't know until it's over how many have died. For example, with the my pandemic, as I call it, the 1918 pandemic, there were three waves. And most of the deaths were concentrated into those three waves over the course of 10 months.
But there was complacency, I think, set in, certainly in the UK, that when the first wave had passed, it's that people kind of relaxed, not bearing sufficiently in mind or knowing that there would be other waves.
Yes, absolutely. And this is really evident through the newspapers here as well and in the UK and globally. And that's one of the issues I have with people saying, oh, don't panic, we shouldn't panic.
If you panic and you get people to wash their hands and we stop the spread of the disease, I think that's a good thing. I think the word panic is actually being misused, because panic, hand washing, stocking up on your medicines for a few weeks, that's rational. You know, it's sensible behaviour.
Yeah.
So I think public health should be interested in a little bit of panic as well.
Pandemic historian Ida Millen on a little bit of panic. And speaking of the P word, Ray Darcy spoke to Professor Clifford Stott on the psychology of stockpiling, or the I'm not hoarding, it's just a big shop.
I think the big problem resides around the use of the term panic.
Okay.
Panic kind of gives us a picture of people freaking out, you know, the idea of being irrational and emotional rather than conscious and deliberate. And that's the problem, really, is that what we're looking at here is people beginning to think about the possibilities that there may be a loss of supply, and they are thinking rationally, well, if I can't get these things in the future, I better get them now. And what happens is it creates unnecessary demand, but it's that unnecessary demand that causes the problem, not panic.
And the cure for all of this may just rely on trust.
Well, we need to trust each other for a start. We need to trust that other people are not going to be selfish, and we need to trust the idea that they're not going to be taking things that we need as well. We need to trust the sources of information that give us instructions about how to do things and reassurances that everything's going to be okay. But again, what the COVID-19 situation is beginning to expose is that where people are at risk from this virus, our capacity to provide solutions is to some extent dependent on equality. So, for example, if we need to quarantine, it's harder for people who don't have access to money, who are poor, it's harder for them to quarantine than it is for middle class people who have access to money. So what's the solution? Well, we need to make society more equal.
Oh, that would be lovely. But in the meantime, maybe just don't buy all the beans. That was Professor Clifford Stott with Ray Darcy. And Ryan Tuberty, well, he's a fan of the experts.
You know that neighbour up the road, or that colleague down the corridor, who knows more about the coronavirus than anyone on the planet Earth? I can pretty much guarantee you they know nothing. The only people who know about it are the people who know about it. And they're on the news every night and every day. And that's who we should be listening to. Not your man or your one. They know nothing. They have half a headline off Twitter, half a story off a Vox Pop on the radio somewhere, and mangle that into a terrorising anecdote to scare you. Nothing. Stick with the experts, lads. They're the ones.
Wise words indeed from Ryan Tuberty. So let's wrap up our COVID-19 coverage by going back to one such expert, the HSC's Dr. Colm Henry, who was on with Áine on yesterday's News at One.
There are concerns, and people are right to be worried, and I'm worried. Yeah. We're all worried about this. But how to channel that worry is really important, and everybody's got a part to play here. And the most important thing people can do are those personal measures, washing their hands, avoiding coughing or sneezing and open, but into their sleeve or into a tissue, mm-hmm. and disposing of the tissue, and then they're washing their hands. If somebody coughs or sneezes in your presence, to stand back 2 metres. These are simple measures that everybody can do to play their part in preventing transmission of this illness.
And I've seen remarkable data in terms of other viruses, vomiting viruses and so on, but the amount of difference in cutting infection, you can halve the rate of infection, I think, can't you, in some cases?
Absolutely.
These simple measures.
And they're simple measures that can apply to everybody, and everybody's got a part to play.
And forgive me, but this is a question we were asking on the desk this morning. Is it okay for parents to hug their little ones, or should we stop? Should we avoid that kind of close contact? Because a lot of the spread, hasn't it, in clusters have been within families and people you have close contact with.
One could argue that at times like this, people need to hug their children
even
closer.
More, yeah.
So I certainly wouldn't give that advice. I've told you that the correct advice is, and I repeat it, we can't repeat it enough. These are basic measures. Hand washing. Don't touch your eyes, your nose or your mouth, because if you do happen to pick up that droplet, that's where it enters your body. Yeah.
So maybe if you come home and you want to give your kids a hug, wash your hands and face first.
Absolutely. And teach your children how to wash your hands, your face. And there's one of the better examples of social media, there's lovely examples of children showing adults how to wash their hands properly, and they're often better and more compliant than adults are, I'm afraid.
Yes, and that's nice advice, actually, to go on hugging. Thank you very much indeed for that. And good luck to you and all your team in the weeks ahead.
Oh, I think we all might need a little bit of a hug. It's been a tough week. That was Dr. Colm Henry of the HSC. So, scrub, keep yourself clean and sing happy birthday. Or, if happy birthday is getting a bit tedious, here's Oliver Callan with a few alternatives.
Going to take a lot to get those germs away from you. Give it a good scrub. More foam. Press the thing. Get more foam. Oh, it's high. There's the reins. Give it nice, nice and clean. Now, if you're a child of the 80s, maybe this might be easier for you to remember. Wash, wash, wash. No, Prince. You can't. No, don't get it. Secondhand stores, you know, wash your hands after you get the raspberry beret from the store. Another 20 seconds. Dolly Parton. Go clean, go clean, go clean. Scrub, yeah. In between the fingers, around the base of the thumb. That's where all those dirty Dolly Parton germs are living. You know, that's what you call them, because they're dancing on your hand, not because Dolly Parton. You know what I mean. Now, there are also songs that you probably shouldn't be singing, and these are the ones that might upset the HSE advice. Neil Diamond might upset Simon Harris with this. No, you touch your own hands. There, Neil, don't touch. Don't. No, no, no reaching out. No, just keep your hands clean. Don't. Touching. No, no touching. No touching. That's going to spread it. No, oh, please, no, don't. Wrong. He's got it all wrong. Maybe MC Hammer, listen to his advice.
You can't touch this.
Yeah, don't touch that. You never know what's been.
You can't touch this.
Oh, God, don't touch that. Get the wipes, baby wipes. Antibacterial. Antibacterial.
Rub-a-dub-dub, we'll be back and virus-free after this break. Welcome back. Now, it's hard lines when you're looking to government formation for a bit of light relief, but then again, these are strange days. On Thursday morning, Sean O'Rourke spoke to Micheál Martin.
Have you decided you're prepared to enter coalition with Fine Gael?
Yes. Again, depending on a programme for government that works and that represents a new direction in terms of housing, health and climate change.
So, a mere 4 weeks after the general election and in just 11 seconds, the door has been officially opened. However, when Micheál Martin met the party faithful later that day, well, they weren't all so keen. There was a feeling that Fianna Fáil shouldn't exclude talking to, whisper it, Sinn Féin. Here's Fiach Kelly, deputy political editor of the Irish Times.
Someone there told me it was almost like, you know, they couldn't name Sinn Féin. It was that other party, or we should talk to them, or it. It was never explicitly said. But I think this was different because it wasn't usually just your John McGuinnesses and your Eamon O'Queeves having a go as they usually do. This was people who are dissatisfied with how Micheál Martin is conducting negotiations and wanted to lay a marker down. Other criticisms, while they did not actually say that he should go into government with Sinn Féin, they're saying you should at least talk to him. But there was another slight criticism of his approach, that there was another cohort of people who didn't say that he should talk to Sinn Féin, but criticise him for repeatedly attacking Sinn Féin. Now, one criticism I think particularly stung, according to those present at the meeting, Robert Troy said, this idea that you keep going on about shadowy figures running Sinn Féin, there are unelected figures in all parties, including our own, who direct policy. And I think, as someone said to me, Micheál flipped at that point. Now, against that, those who were in favour of Martin's negotiating position were actually quite happy when they left the room. They said this was a fight that needed to be had at this point, and he showed a bit of fire in the belly by taking them on at the end, I think.
Let's just take a moment to bathe in the comforting predictability of party political business as usual. Reassuring. Bowman on Sunday marked the 250th birthday of the College Historical Society in Trinity College, Dublin, a society noted for honing the oratorical skills of the great and just the verbose. Here's broadcaster Sean McRaymon listing just some of the society members.
Wolfe Tone, Thomas Addis Emmett, Robert Emmett, Thomas Davis, John Blake Dillon, Isaac Butt, Edward Carson, Dermot Coffey, Gerald Sweetman, Owen O'Mahony, Lord Glenavy, Alfred Percival Graves, Standish O'Grady, Douglas Hyde, Thomas Moore, Oliver St. John Gogarty, Oscar Wilde, Sean O'Hagerty.
From the 1970 documentary Role of the Hist in Irish Society, and from that same programme, here's Trinity historian and former society member R.B. McDool.
As we know, this society lives from crisis to crisis. I would prefer perhaps to change indeed the preposition and say lives on crisis to crisis. Without a crisis, the society would find life somewhat monotonous. Now, but on the other hand, there's one great point about a crisis in the College Historical Society. It mustn't go on too long or it becomes boring. And...
Ooh, he might well have been talking about government formation. That was from Bowman on Sunday. And another gentleman with a sharp way with words is singer and rapper Lethal Dialect. He was Sean Rock's guest on Arena. And here's a wee taster of his song, K-District.
Living in the K-District, it's no picnic. They raise misfits who blow big clips and make hit lists. They don't miss, kid, don't say shit if you've no business. They might mistake you for a state witness. Living in the K-District, it's no picnic. They raise misfits who blow big clips and make hit lists. They don't miss, kid, don't say shit if you've no business. They might mistake you for a state witness. Where we're from, they're not conservative, they're political. Conservatives and liberals, the squares and then the criminals. We were taught to keep the verbal to a minimal, cause certain individuals be serving up medicinal. Move away around the area is traditional. The smarter heads know that when you're earning, keep invisible. You rarely reach the pinnacle. And if you do, you're on the boss, bumps you off, cause business never personal's the principle. Still, the younger boys swear that they're invincible. But if they study history, they'd learn that shit is cyclical.
Goes around, comes around.
They say your early years are pivotal. They taught me that reality's more scary than the fictional. See me cousin rush to the emergency and critical over the situation you would swear was only trivial. I reckon that's the reason that I'm permanently cynical.
K-District from Lethal Dialect, also known as Paul Allwright. And Sean Rocks asked him about that song title.
It's the term the Gardaí use. It's their district for Blanchardstown, Cabra and Finglas, which are three areas that I lived in and sort of grew up in. So,
Living in the K District, it's no picnic. Would it's you not, agree with yourself there?
It's certainly no picnic, no.
Yeah. So how bad was it growing up, or what did you see growing up that is really making its way into your music?
To be honest, it wasn't like, you know, it's almost cliche for a rapper to have a struggle, a sort of tough upbringing. There was stuff that went on and stuff you'd seen that probably wasn't normal, but I had a very good upbringing, you know. More to do with the family, a solid family unit, and they made sure that, you know, we stayed out of trouble and stuff like that. But
you obviously saw things that disturbed you.
Absolutely,
There's one line in the midst of that K-District song where you talk about, oh, the young fellas, they think they're invisible, but no, things are cyclical.
Yeah,
what goes around comes around is a little sample dropped in. You saw that type of thing, did you, young fellas who thought they were invincible?
Definitely, yeah. And even knowing what happened to generations before them, because, you know, there's a lot of pubs in Cabra where, you know, things have went on and it's there in the news, it's there playing for all to see, and they would have been aware of that, they would have seen it, they would have been hanging around outside on bicycles when things like that happened. And it still didn't deter them, you know.
And there's another line in there that jumped out of my eyes. It was, listen, keep the verbals to a minimum. Now, you're a rapper. You clearly didn't follow that advice.
No, but there's another line I have on Strawberry Glue, and I think it said, they know I write, but that I speak with discretion. You know? So you have to choose your words very carefully. Someone talks a lot, spread rumours, and, you know, rumours lead to people being arrested and stuff. Basically,
Whatever you say, say nothing.
Yeah, or rats out spraying on the wall, you know, stuff like that.
Lethal Dialect as heard on Arena. In the aftermath of Turkey deciding to open its borders, migrants and refugees have been coming into Greece. Dr. Victoria Bradley from Donegal was among a group of doctors who were volunteering on the island of Lesbos, and they had just left the refugee camp and were driving through the olive grove when they were confronted by a group of men.
And there were 8 cars in convoy. We were trying to all stay together. And then we were stopped by maybe 50 men in cars that were... They were carrying people with 6 cudgels. Some of them had nails sticking out of them. Some of them had poles. There were open-back trucks with men on them. People with motorcycle helmets on their heads. So they wouldn't let us past. And then they started to shout at us. And because we're NGOs, they don't want any NGOs on the island at the moment because they think it encourages refugees. So one man, I was in the back seat and he kicked my window in, so there was glass everywhere, and then tried to kick me in the head. We pulled out, all hell broke loose. Then the protesters were also hitting the car with rocks and with sticks and poles or whatever. So our windscreen was all smashed. Then I don't know how we got out, and we managed to pull out. The protesters were chasing us. And then we managed to, a local person on a motorbike actually tried to stop the protesters following us, which was very good. We had to take refuge with the refugees, and the refugees were the ones who helped us.
And Dr. Bradley gave her view of the situation on the island.
It's not tenable. There are 20,000 refugees. 400 arrived to Lesbos yesterday. The local people on Lesbos, their life has, like, they've lost their livelihoods. It's wrong what happened yesterday. But the islanders are overwhelmed. They can't cope. The refugees have no choices but to leave where they're leaving. Like the stories that we've been told by refugees about what they're running from, like, you know, a mother might say that her children were killed 2 months ago in a bomb in Afghanistan, or somebody else might say how they were raped by people smugglers just because she didn't have enough money to get her 5 children across in the boat, so the smugglers raped her as payment.
You're at the airport now as we speak. Have you made That's a decision right. then to leave and come home?
We have, because, and honestly, I feel guilt about that, for leaving the refugees now with no doctors. But at the same time, I mean, the people yesterday, I think if they'd got us out of the car, you know, it could have been difficult, to say the least.
Did you feel yesterday that your life was at risk?
It was.
Dr. Victoria Bradley with Claire Byrne on the News at 1. Mary O'Rourke has taken part in a programme where OAPs give advice, and she came in to Ray Darcy to talk all about it, and he sprang a problem to her about a cat. Long story, don't ask. But it did prompt this very touching recollection about Jason the dog.
We had a dog for years and years, a lovely, lovely basset hound. You know, the big
yes,
eyes. And,
yes.
And we had him. He would, when he died, he was 107 years.
In dog years, yeah.
In dog years. And the kids grew up with him, the two boys, and they loved him. Mm. And he just died of plain old age.
Yeah.
Oh, it was lovely. He got to a point, he wouldn't take food from any of the three of them, Enda, Fargan or Angus. But they used to have to wait until I came home from Dublin, and he would take the food from me. And then one April day, it was lovely and sunny, and I said to Enda, we'll put him out in the back garden on the rug. And we did. And it went on, it went to 7 or 8 o'clock, and I said, we better take him in. And wasn't he dead?
And you never replaced him, Mary?
No, we didn't. And I thought, how lovely to die on a rug in the back garden with the sun beaming down on him. Yeah, yeah. No, we never replaced him. We thought there never could be another Jason.
Oh, God, that's just lovely. But this in turn led the conversation to all kinds of matters, existential and profound.
Don't the Buddhists say we should contemplate death at least once a day?
Oh, do they really?
Yes, yeah.
I didn't know that.
There you go.
Yeah, well, I do. And the older I get,
and what
the more I think about it.
And what do you think about when you contemplate death?
Well, I just say, well, I know there is somewhere, we're going somewhere. And then an odd time I might think of all the very bold things I did long ago, long, long ago. And I say, oh, I hope the Lord knows that I've got much more sensible and much more grown up. And then I always say a prayer when I get into bed at night to the Lord, and that I'll wake up in the morning, which I do every morning. And after that, I don't think too much.
Okay. Right,
I'd like to go with no fuss. I don't want any fuss. I just want to die.
Like Jason in
like
the back
Jason
garden.
Like Jason did
on
in
an
the
April
back
day
garden.
On a rug.
Oh, you could do a lot worse. That was Mary O'Rourke with Ray Darcy. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Well, get out the good china, because the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge, Will and Kate, landed in for a visit. Here's the view from the BBC's Johnny Diamond, as heard on Tuesday's News at 1.
The royals occupy a sort of odd place in the diplomatic world. They have this extraordinary power, which is a soft power. You know, it's not guns and it's not trade. and it's not sort of uniforms. It's something different, and it's very difficult to describe quite what it is. Back in the UK, I always described them as being a kind of Ministry of Fun or a Department of Good Times. And I think that's what it is when they come abroad. They just sort of come around and sort of spread good feelings and good feelings about Britain. And as I don't have to tell you or your listeners, relationships haven't always been that good between our two islands. And I think the royal family really does feel that weight. I think there is a genuine affection for Ireland.
Ministry of Fun and Good Times, Will and Kate. Well, I suppose that depends on your definition of fun. But later that day, Drive Time's Fergal Keane was out and about and cast his forensic eye over the rig outs.
Do you want to know what she was wearing?
Well, no, we're not going to do that. No. I'm actually being told in my ear that we do want to know, but you and I are going to make a brave departure from convention here, and we're not going to talk about what the Duchess is wearing. What was the Duke of Cambridge wearing?
Well, he was wearing, I actually took a note of that, a very dark blue suit, slim cut suit and a long dark coat with a shirt and tie. And by the way, the Duchess was wearing a dress by Alexander Rich and a dark green coat by Catherine Walker, green shoes, green bag. Two very tall, elegant figures, both of them.
Very brave shade of green. Would you have pulled it off?
Not the dress, the coat I might have. The coat now is very dark. I'd call it almost Irish Guards green. But the dress, no, is a patterned green thing. I wouldn't wear it in a tie myself.
Strike a pose. Who knew that was Fergal Vogue Keane? And the next day, he was back on the fashion front row.
Then they went a little bit walkabout in Temple Bar, where there were hundreds of, or not dozens of photographers following him, taking photographs. Of course, what they were wearing was the main subject of conversation for everybody. But then we went on to Teagasc this afternoon.
Don't hold back, Fergal.
Sorry?
Don't hold back. What were they wearing?
Well, Mary, since you ask, he was wearing blue slim fit chinos, a light green round neck sweater with a cutaway collar, light blue shirt. And this morning he had suede boots. He changed them this afternoon to more brown practical boots for a farmer. But I think you're probably asking me about what Kate was wearing.
Well, both, actually.
This morning she was wearing... Well, I told it was a cream jacket, a waistline cream jacket by Rees, affordable high street trader, black jeans and boots. And then she changed dramatically. She changed this afternoon. She wore a green Dubarry wax jacket, belted jacket, also then had the black jeans. But then she also had what I would call kind of posh farmer boots, knee-high brown leather boots, either by Dubarry or Musto. And
Drive Time's own Winitor, and to think that man reported from war zones. Darling, what an eye. But on Thursday, I think it's fair to say that sartorial standards had dropped.
The Duchess wore a green polka dot midi dress designed by Susanna Winters, and I hope that's up to our fashionista colleague Fergal Keane standards, Mary.
Yeah, well, you've a big mountain to climb there, John.
Oh, John Cook, green polka dot midi dress. What shade of green, John? What size were the polka dots? But between visits to Lundus, pints of the black stuff controversially, hill walks in Howth and general warm and fuzzy feelings, Evelyn O'Rourke captured the royal visit thus.
Everybody you speak to who's met them is just kind of a bit giddy and says, lovely, 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 that's all you hear.
Possibly, but not so for everyone. Here's Fiona Looney with an alternative travel itinerary.
I think we should bring them to somewhere, actually, a bit unpleasant, like Kilmainham Jail, you know, somewhere actually, and say, you know what, this is what you actually did to us, and this is the reason we've a complicated relationship, and we're not all Guinness and hurling, and you know,
yeah.
And you know, rather than just be all about the kind of the, you know,
it's easy for her to wear green all the same because she has green in her eyes. It's flattering for
her.
Did
you notice that?
Fashionista Ray angling for Fergal Keane's job there. Now, for followers of machinations across the water in the US, this was a significant week, and in particular Tuesday, or rather Super Tuesday. And odds are Joe Biden will be the Democrats' choice to go toe-to-toe with the Donald. And it turns out Ryan Tuberty has a Biden story.
I met Joe Biden once, and I had introduced him onto to a thing, and they said, could you meet him afterwards? And I said, no, I can't, because I had to dash off. And very kindly, I was at an event that night, the American Ireland Fund dinner. And afterwards, they said, actually, he'd like to say hello to you because you did that thing earlier. I said, geez, I'd be honoured. As it happens, I was with one of my sisters. And they led us down little tunnels. He'd be out in a second. Sure enough, he came out. And I said, well, absolute pleasure to meet you. Boys have been kind of watching him down through the years on Meet the Press when he was either a candidate or a senator, whatever it might be. And I'd introduced him. I said, this is my sister, Rachel. And he said, ah. He said, and he turned to me, he said, now we have something in common. I said, really? He said, what's that? He said, we both have sisters who are better looking than us. And I thought, okay, I'll take that. I'll take that. And off he went, bounded off. A very, very amicable, or friendly person, and a nice guy with it.
Oh, the circles that man moves in. The History Show is back, and Lorca and Clancy went to Lanesborough, County Longford, to gather memories of our great rival, the box in the corner, television.
My first memory of a television, we didn't understand anything about television, was in a bicycle and radio shop in the 50s. I would have been a teenager. But he had this thing in a corner. You could hear just a very, very faint sound. No picture, just fog.
I think every neighbour around the place had a television before we had. Of course, we used to be rambling into different houses at different stages and the telly would be turned on.
We didn't get one at home until we were 14, but we used to go up to our neighbours, the Finnegans, and we used to watch it there. And on a Saturday, we'd be watching The Virginian. It was a great Western, black and white, of course.
People used to be able to get BBC a bit, but it had the snow effect. But it didn't deter people from watching programmes on it because it was always exciting to see this newfangled thing called television, you know.
If there was a kiss or something on the television between two of the actors in whatever show we were watching, and we'd all start giggling and laughing, and then we'd want to practice on one another. It was the nearest we got to a blue movie in them days.
The History Show on Sunday, and for the record, you wouldn't get that kind of muck on the radio. Classier beast. Well, we are almost at a finish here on Playback. I'm away next week, but should Montrose be compromised, for that is the phrase, rest assured, we will continue to broadcast.
Well, I can tell you now, and probably shouldn't, but there'd be people broadcasting from all over the country. I'd be broadcasting from the spare room at home. Brian Dobson be doing Morning Ireland from his kitchen. Marty Whelan, don't really know yet. Don't really know yet, but people will be occupying roadcasters and roadies and all sorts of things because they wouldn't be able to come in to the radio building. The big word is compromised. If the building is compromised, they're going to have one studio completely surgically cleaned, and that'll be ready so that if another studio is compromised, we'll be fast-tracked over there. If that's compromised, it's off home to the spare room.
Marty, Ray and Brian in their onesies from the good room. It doesn't bear thinking about. Well, that is it from this week's Playback. Thank you for listening. I'll talk to you in a fortnight. And in the meantime, keep clean and keep dancing.
Todinho dela.
Chega, mano.
Na lua prateada se esconder e só dourado aparecer. Amanheceu um lindo dia,
cheirando alegria, pois eu sou